Hello, I'm Kimberly Dondo, Digital Content Manager, and welcome to the In Conversation With series, a series where I speak to notable figures in the realm of financial services. Listen as they share their personal journeys, thoughts on the industry, and advice for aspiring advisors. Hello, and today I'm joined by Justin Onukasi. And Justin, do you want to give a better introduction of yourself? Because I know that I don't know as much about you as you do.
Yeah, thank you so much. So, yes, Justin Onukasi. I am the head of retail investments for EMEA at Legal & General Investment Management, one of the largest asset managers in the world. The idea is that I'm overseeing the investment floor for the retail part of the business. So this is going into wealth managers, going into financial advisors, and really trying to package, think about the investment capabilities that we have working with distribution and marketing so that they make sense for the clients that will buy them. And secondly, the second part of my role is I am the head of retail multi-asset funds, managing a number of multi-asset funds in the retail space, and the model newly launched model portfolios, which we launched for advisors as well. So lots of stuff on the investment side. On top of that, I do work from a diversity and inclusion perspective for the industry, thinking about how we can make the industry more of a level playing field. But then also within LGIM, I have a focus on that as well. I'm sitting on the Global Diversity Leadership Council that LGIM has set up to try and drive diversity strategy across the business.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds like a lot. I'm sure you're a very busy man. So thank you for talking to me today. So let's start at the beginning. How did it all start for you getting into financial services?
So I never really necessarily as a kid wanted to get into financial services. I think initially I wanted to be a doctor up until the age of 11, 12. Then I wanted to be a lawyer. And then I remember doing work experience when I was a year 10 student in Manchester Crown Court, mm-hmm. or Manchester County Court it was actually. So Manchester County Court. And I remember I was looking forward to being in the court, and I was in the office for most of the week and then most of the 2 weeks. And I was one day in court and I found it so boring. And so then following that, I was like, well, what do I want to do? And I always enjoyed maths. I always really, really enjoyed maths, particularly in secondary school, less so at A level, but particularly at secondary school. And so I always wanted to use my maths in whatever I did. Mm-hmm. And then that was after wanting to be a lawyer. So then I thought, let me try and utilize this maths passion that I have. So then I started to look up like different professions. But it wasn't until I went to do my A levels, I was walking around the open day for A levels, and I bumped into, and I always wanted to do maths because I like maths. I always wanted to do politics actually, because politics was just really interesting to me. And then economics kind of sat in the middle of that, right? So
right.
It was a blend of maths and politics in a way. But I bumped into the head of maths at that open day for a sixth form college called Holy Cross. I remember his name, Mr. Kiley was his name. Mm-hmm. And he told me about this profession, which I'd never heard of before, called the actuarial profession.
Right.
Never heard it before. And he was like, this is a secret profession. You get to use your maths. He told me it's the most well-paid profession in the world. And it was like this kind of this mystique profession I'd never heard of, which just seemed so brilliant. And it was that time after that open day, throughout my sixth form at college, and then when I went to university and did economics, I was almost determined to become an actuary because of almost what he told me. So I was willing to be an actuary anywhere, right? And because I was originally from Manchester, I had no real geographical preference. But it was clear when I got to my second year that the whole of the economic class seemed to want to go down to London.
Right.
But also that's where the availability of jobs were, right? So yeah. I applied for jobs like crazy, actuarial jobs. I remember I did over 60 application forms. I didn't hear back from most of them. Got rejected by a lot of them. And then there was a few that came back to me. One was Aon.
Mm-hmm.
They were the first company that said yes to me. They did some really nice, actually, which is they put us all up in a hotel the night before.
Okay.
That for the graduate program. These small things have a big impact on me. I mean, I'd never stayed in a hotel in central London before, right?
Right.
Yeah. And I remember there was a TV in the bath.
It was a fancy hotel.
Yeah, I'd never seen anything like that before. And we had dinner before with the grads the year before. And it was just the whole experience was a really, really nice experience. And then, so I decided to join Aon as a pension consultant and studied actuarial exams. But I didn't really, even though this was my dream, I didn't really enjoy it. I remember thinking this is a dream job, I've made it, all the rest of it. And then I started doing the work. I just didn't enjoy it. And, it's for some people really enjoy that kind of work, but it just wasn't for me. It was too slow moving.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was almost like fate in a way. We had a training course from the investment consulting team.
Mm-hmm.
And the investment consulting team, they gave advice to pension funds on assets rather than just the liabilities in a way. And listening to that training course, it blew my mind. And I knew that from that, I really wanted to be in investments. I'll tell you the rest of that story in a second. But then, after that, I emailed the head of investment consulting and I basically said, I really want to move to investments. And it was a really kind of, I was only 8 months into the, sorry, 6 months into the role. So it's quite a big thing for me to do. But I realized that I had to follow this passion. I had to do it. So, and then within 2 months, I'd been interviewed by the head of investment consulting and a team leader. And then I was on the investment floor, dropped the actuarial exam, started doing the CFA. But you know what's really interesting?
Mm-hmm.
You'd think that, and there was 16 people in my graduate program from Farnborough, Harrow, and London. And we all did this training course on investments. And there's loads of training things that we did. And I remember saying to somebody afterwards that I love that training course. That was the thing that got me into investments or thinking about investments. And the feedback on that training course was really awful from everybody apart from me. That was so it was actually something that I was personally passionate about.
Yeah,
and other people just didn't find it that interesting.
Yeah.
So I think that's just a really interesting point.
Yeah. No, I mean, when something connects with you, it connects with you. It might not connect with everyone else, but as long as it connects with you, I guess that's the positive from that.
I agree.
Uh-huh. And so how have you found kind of navigating through since you've transitioned into investments? How has that been for you?
So I think one of the things that really benefited me is that I was reasonably academic. So it meant that passing my exams was I wouldn't say it was easy, but I was able to do it early on.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me a lot. I was able to do it very quickly. And that gave me a lot of credibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in those days, the CFA exams that I started to do were June, but level one, you could do in December. Mm-hmm. So as soon as I moved to the investment floor, well, I think it was around about August time, I started studying for this December exam, passed that one, then passed level two, then the June after, then passed level three. So within less than 3 years, I was qualified from a CFA perspective. And then I was getting pushed out to go and see clients because I built this credibility of passing the exam so quickly. Like, go and see clients. And then there's quite a lot of turnover. So I was going to see clients, and I felt like I'm going to see all these trustees who are like, you know, at the time I was 24 and these trustees were like 65 and so, and I just thought, like, you know, I felt so out of place.
Right.
It was, so I felt that I had to get more credibility and more confidence in myself before I went to go and speak to all these trustees. So what I did then is I thought, you know, I'm going to go focus on research. I'm going to go focus on the research that consultants do. And that was fund research at the time. So researching different fund managers.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to say, the transition for me moving from consultant to fund research, despite qualifying for the CFA very quickly, that wasn't easy. It took a long, long time to get the move. And eventually I moved to Merrill Lynch as a fund researcher, where I research funds. Following that, and again, my numbers in terms of researching funds in that 3.5 period at Merrill Lynch, I mean, I was researching one of the hardest markets, US equities, during the financial crisis, and the relative numbers were actually really quite good. And, you know, we can say whether that was luck or skill and so on and so forth. And I've got lots of views on luck versus skill. But what happened is after that, I built a credibility in researching managers. The head of portfolio construction at Merrill Lynch went to Aviva to go and set up a multi-asset team. And then he asked me to come along with him. It's worth noting, actually, I only got into Merrill Lynch because I knew somebody who used to work at Aon. Who recommended me in quite an assertive way to the line manager. And then when I moved to Aviva, again, it was down to this person who I'd worked with at Merrill Lynch, who headed up the multi-asset team, who brought me in there. And but it was really once I got to Aviva that I realized that within investments, managing money was really where I wanted to be. And actually looking at changing and, you know, meeting clients' investment outcomes. So just to kind of going back then, your question around how has that journey been? It's actually been very difficult. Because the first thing is to be a fund manager, to get to be a fund manager and to try and be a successful fund manager who can raise assets. And that LGIM, now we've raised in retail, we've raised 11 billion. The whole team manages 60 billion pounds. Say retail, 11 billion pounds. So we've been relatively successful. We've been successful, right? It's hard not to say we haven't been successful. But right. I think to be successful is... in fund management, it's really hard. It's not easy. It does mean that at times you have to push yourself, you know, really, really hard to understand the markets, understand risk, understand, you know, the especially in the early days, the amount of work I was doing to try and just keep up, try and understand markets, try and unpick them. I think, and I look back now, and it was a huge amount of work to try and get up to speed and really know. The amount of work I did to try and be a good communicator to advisors, again, you know, understand advisor businesses. I know right now I still annoy the sales team because every time I go into a client meeting, I'm like, I need to understand more about this client so I can empathize and I can understand where they're going, et cetera, et cetera. The amount of work that takes it's actually quite hard. So that's from a professional perspective to get up to speed technically and so on and so forth. But then from a personal perspective as well, again, it's a challenge, right? Because I'm this kind of, I grew up in Manchester, single parent home, not in the most well-off area. And then I was dropped almost into these companies where I felt so different. I remember it was often the case I'd be the only black person in the room. I'd be the only person who had a northern accent in the room. And it felt uncomfortable. I felt that it was really hard for me to be myself. And it's only in the recent years that I feel more comfortable being able to be myself. Now I can almost define my own culture of the people that I'm managing and so on and so forth. And we shouldn't underestimate the impact that has on people's performance, people's mental well-being, people's chances for promotion, people's chances for progressing within a business. Really, really, really important. And I think it's often overlooked because it's often overlooked.
I think I can completely relate to that. And I assume it's completely overlooked because people don't tend to want to talk about it. It can make, as much as it can make, you know, the other people on the other side feel uncomfortable hearing it, it feels uncomfortable to talk about it. You know, I've experienced that my whole life since I moved to England. So for me, it became the norm. If I went into a room and there was more than one other black person there, I would actually be like, whoa. Wow, diversity. Growing up, I was just very used to just being in a room full of white faces, and that just became very normal for me. But I can assume from that might be what has motivated you to get involved in kind of a lot of diversity and inclusion programs, like the ones that you are involved in.
Yeah, I think it has. I think I always had another passion, actually, is that when I left Manchester, I always had a passion that I always wanted to be able to go back to Manchester and say to people that, you know, if you do work hard, you do focus on your education, there is a path that you can be professionally successful. And therefore, all of these other distractions, you can focus on, you know, you can navigate them and focus on this, and you can win, you can be successful. Mm-hmm. Because I think for so many people growing up, and even for me now, it's hard to when you look back and you say, I had no idea that this world even existed. I had no idea that I could ever reach the heights that I've reached. Mm-hmm. So if I can give that hope to others, if I can give them the opportunity to see a different world, see a different perspective, then I think it's really, really important. So that's really important. But the other thing that's really important is when you get into the workplace, there were times where I would go home and you know, I'd really beat myself up where, you know, I had a bad day, someone said something to me the wrong way, and it was I was offended by it, or I just felt, you know, I choked in a presentation, or because, you know, I felt I couldn't communicate in the right way because everyone around the room is a lot smarter than me. All of these kind of challenges, you know, when it came to negotiating salary, when it came to trying to show leadership, when it came to going out to the pub. You know, I used to do this thing where when people used to go to the pub, I never used to want to go to number one.
Right.
But I used to wait until later on, because by the time, you know, if I got there later on, people had drank enough anyway. They kind of forgot I was there anyway. So yeah. And everyone was more relaxed and so on and so forth. And so I used to do it all the time. And it used to be something that I would, I'd do to try and navigate this feeling of feeling out of place.
Right.
And I think part of the challenge there is that I didn't have any role models that looked or sounded like me.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really important. All the studies now, I'm doing some work with London Business School,
mm-hmm.
which tells us that when we think of role models,
mm-hmm.
the first thing we look for is somebody that looks like us. The second thing is they're the same gender. And then after that, it's people that sound like you. Mm-hmm. You need to find common ground typically with a role model to have that association with them.
Yeah.
So that's just really important. The second thing then is being the only one in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can see people and link to role models, if you can see people who've been the only person in the room who are now successful,
mm-hmm.
then that is a big inspiration, I think, to other people. I think that's important. And then the last point here is, and this is coming out more, so I do these mentoring circles every month where people who are just starting off in the industry, 0 to 0 years, trying to navigate the industry, I get role models to kind of talk to them about all of these different challenges, all these different things about navigating the workplace. One key thing is a shared experience as well, where if you have a cohort together, you have these shared experiences. That's really powerful. I never had that because typically, I got asked a question on a panel the other day around what was the biggest advice I'd had from somebody as I've gone through the workplace to navigate this, you know, trying to feel like an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't meet a black fund manager until 2017. So I started the industry in 2003, right? So I didn't meet a black fund manager for 15 years. So there was nobody that I could see in institutional fund management that I could look up to and say, actually, you're my role model. You've got to this position. I'm going to try to achieve it. And that is it. And maybe it's psychological. Other people say, well, you don't need role models, but actually, you know, when you look at psychology, it's really, really important to have those role models.
Yeah. It gives you that extra push and that aspiration, I guess, to be able to look at someone and be like, yeah, I want to aspire to be like that person.
I agree. That's why I do focus on mentoring, and what I try to do is I look for black role models,
mm-hmm.
Because there are so few. I mean, you've got 12 black fund managers. Mm-hmm. If you look at the report in 2017 in the whole of the City of London, mm-hmm. actually having some black role models and trying to seek them out from my own network, the feedback's been really inspiring for people that didn't know they existed. And I just want to cover. I just want to cover one last thing on this.
Yeah.
I think it's always a challenge for people who have those role models to understand the importance. Or to not understand the importance of having them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And there's a specific challenge with representation in our industry, In order to, and I'm a strong believer, in order to deal with that challenge, you have to be very specific. So if, you know, you think there's a lack of women in the industry, which there are at kind of the top level and investment levels, mm-hmm. you have to come up with specific initiatives to focus on getting more women in the industry. If you think there's a lack of ethno-minorities, or let's say a lack of black people for managing mm-hmm. levels, which again, we know 12 out of thousands is absolutely ridiculous, mm-hmm. then you have to have initiatives and policies that focus on getting better representation in that area. Mm-hmm. I think that is fundamental, I think, to driving change, is you have to be specific, you have to be direct. Otherwise you're not really going to address the issues.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. But like looking at the other side of it in terms of attracting the talent into the industry, I guess not everyone is going to have the chance to kind of have like the teacher who told you about actuaries and told you, and then from there you've been able to progress. You know, not everyone has that conversation. I've been talking to a lot of financial advisors about how they got into the industry, and it's all very much a I tripped and fell into this. So do you because you are doing a lot of like mentorship work as well as looking at getting more diversity within the industry, is there also that outlook of something of how to attract from like where you were going to apply for sixth form college, you know, from that you finish your GCSEs, what's next?
Yes. So I think there is, we clearly have to do better to attract talent into the industry. You know, you saying that people have fallen into the industry, where there were a lot of people do, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel like we are going out and attracting the best talent out there into this industry. And a good example, and I'm a big Manchester United, I'm going to take this from somebody else mentioned this, not me, so I'm going to take it from that anyway. But I'm a big Manchester United fan, which is true,
obviously.
If you look at football clubs, when they bring youth players into their team, when they go out and bring people who are gonna, you know, the youngest players in their team, they go out, they search pretty much the whole of the world now, and they try and seek out this junior talent, and they then, you know, will train them in order to, you know, get into the first team. So United with Marcus Rashford, for example, mm-hmm. who is an exceptional human being. You know, they found him, what was it, 7 years old, mm-hmm. And they used to, you know, go to his house, get him to drive him to the, you know, drive him to the, get to training, and so on and so forth. I think that asset managers can take a real lesson there from football clubs and maybe financial advisors as well. And so if you really, truly want the best talent that the world has to offer, what we should do, then actually we have to go out and find it. And then that talent won't all be in Russell Group universities. It won't all be people that have done maths or people that have done economics. So we have to widen the net and really attract the best talent that we can. But then, really importantly, I don't think just taking the best talent and just dropping them into a culture that isn't conducive for retaining, progressing and promoting that talent is that helpful either. So you also have to look at your culture and ensure that it's inclusive and ensure that there are no barriers and there's a level playing field as people could progress for your business.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, because you just triggered a memory for me. When I was at university, I had like a part-time job where I would, it was actually for Merrill Lynch, I would hand out flyers to Cambridge University students, but only we stood outside the maths mm-hmm. building, like where they were where they were coming out for studying maths to get them into these recruitment things so that they could come to the talks and get recruited there. And it was always really interesting to me because I was reading the flyer and I was like, oh, this could be something. But obviously they only want someone who's got a maths you know, background or economics background. Me with my science background, they don't want me, you know, even though you don't know what kind of minds you're turning away, you know. And also, like, just focusing on those certain universities, I've talked to people who, you know, went to lots of different places, maybe didn't even go to university, and I think they were able to just get the qualification, study. They still have that ability to study hard, but I think there is a bit of oversight when it comes to, like, they don't have that foresight to see.
Yeah, that. I completely agree with you.
I think maybe it worked, you know, 50 years ago when the industry was smaller, but as it's expanding and the nation is also expanding and we're becoming more global, I think it's important to have a more flexible perspective, maybe.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it would have been... But, you know, I suppose it's all part of us evolving as a society. You think about my grandmother coming in the Windrush.
Mm.
There are only certain jobs that my granddad could do. There's only certain areas he could live in.
Mm-hmm.
I was allowed to live in.
Mm.
And then they chose Manchester. Actually where they live now, where they lived initially when they came here, it's been completely like bulldozed now. It doesn't exist anymore. But then again, my mum, you know, then part of it had 8 siblings. Only some of them went to university, which again really poor because it was really hard then. It was almost really hard to kind of go to university, and only sort of certain universities really accept you anyway. Mm-hmm. And then there were certain roles then that people her generation were attracted to, a black woman, mm-hmm. attracted to, and it was like, you know, teaching, nursing, and they were the ones that actually wanted greater diversity, greater ethnic diversity at the time.
Yeah.
So now, you know, all I hope is that my children, and I've got 2 girls, I hope that they have, you know, a much greater opportunity set than I did. Mm-hmm. And I think they will. And I think that generational, we talk about generational wealth, mm-hmm. but almost the generational wealth of thinking is really, really important. And I think that, again, people don't fully understand that generational wealth of thinking that passes from generation to generation and means that you can climb the social mobility ladder and so on.
Mm. Yeah, not having that restrictions and not thinking that I can only get to this point and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I was quite lucky that my parents forced me to push from the stars. I had no choice. But yeah, also I think this generation is quite lucky in the way that they have so much information. It might be too much information that they might be overwhelmed with choices. I think they'll probably be hopping from career to career every couple of years. So I guess finally, Justin, I would like you to impart some words of wisdom or advice for anyone who's thinking of joining the industry or anyone who's in the industry currently and might be, you know, feeling that out of place feeling or...
Yeah. I think it's really important thinking about this before I jump into this.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, no, I'll link it into this question. We as kids, like pretty much everybody is told to like work hard at school and so on and so forth and achieve academically, and then that kind of feeds into then the kind of jobs you can get and so on and so forth. I think in the workplace it's also important to work really hard. It, clearly I mentioned about how hard it is as a fund manager to succeed and to progress. It's really difficult, to try and get to be a successful fund manager or a successful fund management team. Really hard. You all got to be working, and sometimes that the work, you know, the work can push you to the limit. But I also think it's really important to work on not just the technical skills, but other aspects of the role.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, one of the things that I try to work on, I don't think I'm necessarily there yet, but I really try to work on empathizing, understanding clients, understanding their journey. And to me, that has to be, I try to make that my differentiator in a way, okay, I'm not going to sit in an ivory tower and just manage portfolios. I'm actually going to get out there. I'm going to see clients. I'm going to go out there, understand the way you think about the investing, the way you think about investment outcomes, the way you think about the way you put portfolios together. And I think that just gives me a real insight of who I'm managing money for. And I think that that's really important. We talk about diversity and representing the people that, or having representation or looking like the people that you're managing money for.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way you do that is surely the way you can do that to the fullest extent is by fully understanding what they want from their investments. And I think ultimately that has held me in really good stead. So I think the advice here is don't just focus on building your technical skill base. You've also have to focus on, you know, building these meaningful relationships because they're so important. I mentioned that, how did I get the job at Merrill Lynch? How did I get the job at Aviva? Actually knowing someone, and I got it on merit, but actually knowing somebody there really helped for people to understand the merit and understand the risk that we're taking. And it's always a risk to hire people.
Yeah.
But it was more understandable because they knew me. So mm-hmm. I think building those networks, building those relationships, either with clients, with people you work with, is just so important, and it really cannot be underestimated. And with the mentoring that I do, the mentoring circles that I do every month,
mm-hmm.
that's one key thing that we're doing. We're building relationships with mentors and mentees, but also mentees to mentees. And I'm building my relationships also with the mentors, right? So
yeah.
it creates this network, which I think is really powerful, and it's going to be really powerful in the future.
Yeah. I experienced how important it is to have a good network of people when I'd like returned to England, and it was in the midst of a pandemic, and I was like, I need a job. Luckily I had a really great network of people that I knew that I could also reach out to, that I had a good relationship, and I have the merit. Yeah. But having that person to kind of say, oh, this person has applied, she's great, I've worked with her, hard worker, you know, that does really help. And I think those soft skills that you were talking about, empathizing with your client, that's a lot of that. I've seen a lot of advisors also talking about that, having those that ability to, because you're going to have some difficult conversations sometimes. And I think it's important to also know that it's not just, you're not just stuck behind a computer. Sometimes you have to get personal. And some people think that that's just a given, but it's not a natural skill for everyone. So
those
are quite important to focus on.
Can I add one last thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll try to be brief because I think it's really important is to understand what authenticity and being yourself means to you.
Right.
I think there's a lot of myths about authenticity and being yourself. And the way I look at it, and I'll just give you, I've taken this from somebody as well, so hopefully they don't come looking for me, is I think about the world, you think about the world, the earth, cut it in half, and you've got your core in the middle, and you've got your mantle around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I have some core values that I'm not willing to move on, and that's the core in the middle of the of the earth. The mantle, however, I've got other values in the mantle which I'm willing to adapt. I'm willing to adapt for the benefit of the team, for the benefit of cognitive diversity, for the benefit of a really good outcome and a peaceful working relationship. Right? It wouldn't work if I was wearing a Manchester United shirt in the office every day. it wouldn't help, right? If I the person I sit next to.
Fan or a
Liverpool fan I sit next to in the office, right? So that definitely wouldn't help, right? My point is that you have to decide, each individual has to decide what they're willing to sacrifice and what they're willing to adapt to in the workplace. But what you cannot adapt on, you cannot sacrifice those core values if ultimately it also means that you can't achieve or meet your potential. Really, really important.
Yeah, definitely. I think those are quite important things to, because if something isn't going to work for your core values, then maybe look elsewhere.
Exactly.
Because it won't be great in the long run. But yeah, that was really great, Justin. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
No problem at all. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to In Conversation With. We do hope that you enjoyed it. Please do keep up to date with all our new releases via Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your podcasts from. You can also keep up to date with all our new content published on the Money Marketing website, as well as our print edition Money Marketing magazine. So make sure to subscribe. Follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. See you next time.